Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. As we learn more and more about psychology and how best to practice psychology, I have been considering this idea that learning about other animals is a way to learn about our own species, and that this learning will be able to influence our learning about psychology in general and improve it. This consideration comes directly from my own experiences, and I'd like to explain that a bit further here. I speak a few languages, not well, but each time I learned a new language, it made me reconsider my first language, which is English. An example of this was when I was learning French, which is my second language. One day, hearing my French teacher explain the terms of endearment, one of them in particular caught my ear. It was mon petit chou. It is a French term for my dear or my sweetheart. But in English, it translates to my little cabbage. I thought this was so interesting at the time, and I still do, actually. I wondered, how were there not the same terms of endearment across all languages? Note, I'm asking how here because up to this point, I assumed that all the words in English were a direct tie to the experience or phenomena they were describing. It didn't occur to me up until this point that there could be different ways to express one's care for another person or being. In other words, there could be different terms of endearment. For example, why wouldn't a term like sweetheart be universal? I just assumed that sweetheart was the encompassing of that whole experience, and it didn't occur to me that there was another way to explain a term of endearment like that. In that moment, I considered what a little cabbage would look like. I actually love to eat cabbage, and while I never saw a small one, I could imagine that a little one would be pretty cute. So I surmised that mon petit chou was akin to something like my little cutie. And in this thought exercise, I realized that the language one uses to express the term of endearment can vary widely from one culture to another. And as I'm sure we'll see, even more within a culture. As I've learned more, I realize it can vary quite a bit. And yet, it is the idea or the experience that is more universal, or at least common. And that is what is being communicated, not the words per se. Understanding this about French made me reflect on all the words we use in English and all the little phrases and kind of quirky terms that we have that mean something or communicate a phenomena or an experience in English. That's when I started becoming aware of how those phrases kind of cover up the actual experience with specific words, and that if I'm not thinking about it, the words and the experience sort of fuse and they become one. But learning about mon petit chou in French made me uncover or start to review all of the terms I learned like that in English. And once you start thinking about it, there are many. In doing so, I was able to decouple the experience from the words. And somehow in doing that larger investigation into learning my first language made me become much more aware of the experiences themselves. It was like being able to take the layer of language off and consider the actual experience and the phenomena helped me to see it more clearly or feel it more clearly than I had in the past when the terms were just sort of covered over and things like my sweetheart or my dear were just words that I used and I didn't think about the actual experience underneath them. As I listen to myself describe this, maybe you might think I have more to learn here in how to express myself. But essentially, what I'm trying to say is that having this experience of language be more expressive in my first language after learning my second is what I'm trying to propose that we do here in this podcast, is to continue to learn about animals and animal behaviors and see what we can understand about those as a sort of second language in order that we can come back to our human-to-human interactions and our human experiences in the same way that I was able to uncover more about English and the English language after I learned French. I'm suggesting that this similar way of learning can be applied to the practice of psychology if we really consider animals from this perspective, in that they have their own language, their own behaviors, their own ways of being that can inform us about human ways of being simply because they are so different. In other words, once we get underneath what we think are universal things and really start seeing how another species expresses them or behaves in a certain way in response to them, then we can get really curious about our human experience of those and more than likely, much like I did, realize that even within humans, these common expressions are quite unique and quite individual. And while it sounds like a large exploration, I think it will end us in a place that we will be able to learn more about ourselves and our species as a result, because it will deepen that learning, much like it did for me. I hope it does for you, and that's why I'm going to be focusing on this way. So in case you, like me, have an interest in working therapeutically with animals, the application is clear that these studies will help us do that. But even if you don't, and you plan to be a therapist who's always in a room or working one-on-one or just solely with humans, I hope in this way that learning about animals also informs your practice. And overall, if you're someone who's curious about all these things and ways of being, I'm hoping that by breaking down each behavior and really thinking about and considering it, we can apply this work to our own species and perhaps see things in a new way. Across species, nonverbal signals are detected from dogs to humans. As in the last episode, number 42, dogs were shown to be gazing differently when they needed assistance from their owners. And in earlier episodes, I described how physical experiences were shared, as in the experience of heart rate variability between horses and humans, and the ability to display nervous system states similarly when dogs smelled vials of human odors. These are episodes 42, 32, and 36, respectively. And implicit in this discussion is the idea that one being in the interaction influences the other being in the interaction. In the case, for example, of dogs smelling the vials of odors from humans in certain nervous states like stressed, then after they smelled that, the dog started displaying what dogs do when they are stressed. And that's what I mean by these things can influence from one being to the other. And so taking this idea of influence a step further, there is also an area of research called appeasement signals. It goes by a variety of names, but it's the idea that one being does behaviors to appease the other. The way the authors describe it in the study I'm going to share is that, quote, behaviors that display an animal's peaceableness, like wanting to be peaceful, and that inhibit, reduce, or end aggressive behavior of social partners are summarized under the term appeasement behavior. These signals constitute context and response-dependent sequences, which are part of a ladder leading to threats or overt aggression when ignored. So it's this category of behaviors that animals are displaying when that they want to be peaceable. In other words, they don't want to fight. And the thought is that animals display these in an effort to inhibit, reduce, or end aggressive behavior. So there's lots of examples, and I'm going to share one here today, but this would include the idea that Mark Beckoff talked about with the play bows of dogs in episode 8. As a reminder, what happens there is he was describing how dogs kind of bow their front legs and wag their tail as a way to alert other dogs they intend to play and not be aggressive. That's a rather overt sign of these appeasement behaviors, but the research I've been reading lately is there's actually many sort of very subtle signs that species can display both within species and across species that signal this idea that they don't want a conflict. And in case we're thinking that humans don't want to do this, I invite you to consider the last time you were in traffic where there's perhaps rush hour or some other situation where traffic can get aggressive. And I know for myself, I do it, and I've seen many other, it's rather common display of your intent not to have road rage is to sort of wave the person on in front of you when it's their turn to merge into the lane or something like that. So I think it's actually way more common than perhaps meets the eye at first to consider how many ways we are signaling to other humans in this case, while we're all operating motor vehicles, that we intend to sort of merge peaceably. And this happens, you know, when you walk into a public building and maybe you walk up to the door at the same time as the other person. There's a way that, you know, someone kind of nods or pauses. And this is a nonverbal way to explain that you're either going to be the one that holds the door for the other person, or maybe they're going to hold it for you. It's my understanding these types of behaviors are under the term appeasement, although they do go by multiple terms. But the article today is talking about appeasement signals used by dogs during dog-human communication. I'm pretty excited that we're actually using the phrase dog-human communication in the title of a peer-reviewed journal. It's the Journal of Veterinary Behavior, and it was published in 2017 by authors Fernkees, Bartel, Bedoli, and Erard. And we will, as always, have information in the show notes about this article and links on connectiontherapypodcast.com for your further review. And what they did is they took 116 dogs and put them through some behavioral tests with their owners, and they had other adults display behaviors toward them, either like a neutral behavior, a friendly behavior, or a threatening behavior. And they just looked at two appeasement behaviors. There are many appeasement behaviors that dogs do, and I'll be reviewing more of these in future episodes. But for now, the two behaviors in this study that they considered were looking away and licking of lips. So it's really interesting, and this I find so counterintuitive, and I've mentioned this a couple times on the podcast. For dogs and my experience for horses, when they want to show that they don't want to fight, they actually look away. And that can be difficult for someone participating in equine assisted services, for example, because when you first arrive to the barn, you're sort of hoping, or I'll speak for myself, hoping that the horse is looking at you and ready for you to work with you that day. But actually looking away signals that for their species and for dogs, that they're not intending to, you know, be aggressive. They're sort of showing these appeasement signals. And for dogs, they're also including licking of lips. And so what they did is they took these 116 dogs through this test and then watched video recordings of these two behaviors specifically to see if there were what they call interspecific, that are like interspecies communication between the dogs and the humans. And they are reminding us that there have been previous studies done in dogs and wolves, which show similar appeasement signals. And that's why they picked these two to consider. And what they found is that both signals, the licking of lips and looking away, possibly they feel do serve as appeasement signals in dog-human communication. In other words, dogs, when they look away as you approach or lick their lips, is actually a significant behavior, not just sort of a random thing that dogs do. And they are suggesting specifically that licking of lips was a common component of the, quote, greeting behavior of dogs toward humans, and it was observed significantly more often. So I am raising this study with you today in this episode just to ask your consideration and your awareness of how such subtle things. I know I've spent pretty much my whole life around dogs and never even considered the fact that I'm not even sure I can pick out dogs licking their lips as I approach. I'm usually too excited to talk to them and sort of, you know, looking at different parts of their body to see, you know, how they're going to approach. I don't think to look at their mouth. And also, you know, the looking away, thinking of that as a positive kind of reaction from a dog as I approach is just really counterintuitive. Like my own dogs, you know, have a different way typically of greeting me once I get close enough. But I think I will be watching more specifically now for both of these behaviors to see if I can see them in my dogs and in other dogs and start considering these extremely subtle ways that dogs are letting humans know their intent to be peaceable in an interaction. And lastly, what I invite our consideration is how do we as humans do that? And how perhaps am I showing nonverbal signals that I intend to be peaceable? I like that word, peaceable. As a mental health therapist, I know I do many of those, and now I'm going to consider if I do more than I realized, and also how I can see them in my patients. Because, you know, certainly if someone is kind of self-selecting to participate in therapy, or if they're a child and they agree with their parents that coming to therapy is a good idea, then more than likely we're going to see some of these appeasement signals that they are displaying non-verbally their intent to participate in therapy that day or that session. So I continue the exploration of the wide variety of ways we communicate with each other, and I am thankful for your consideration of these two very subtle behaviors today, and how if it happens in dogs, it probably happens in humans, and would love to hear your experiences. We also have our social media channels listed in the show notes, and if you would like to share the ways that you see some of these behaviors in your dogs or maybe in other ways, we'd welcome your thoughts and feedback. Thanks. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.